Flashback Twin Cities. Tom Osmond here for the next hour on KLBB Club 1220. Tom Hsu working the board.
Oh, it's always a good thing to be here,
mostly
sir.
Functioning board.
Mostly functioning. It may have a few hiccups right now, but we'll get over that.
Should we make our big announcement today?
Let's do.
Well, we got a big announcement. I know that. All right, everyone, take a deep breath. All right, we are going to be on next Saturday and every Saturday until we're not at 2 o'clock p.m. We are going to do a little programming shift here. So instead of 1 o'clock, make sure to set your dials at 2 o'clock. Well, you can just listen to KLBB all day, obviously, but
darn right.
You want to hear my voice, which most people do on Saturdays, right? Anyone?
Okay. Absolutely.
2 o'clock on Saturdays.
And just to add on to there, everything else that follows that would normally be at 2 o'clock is just being pushed back one extra hour.
1 hour.
So your Sounds of Sinatra, 3 o'clock.
Excellent, excellent. So 2 o'clock, Flashback Twin Cities next Saturday. We have Tom Mischke on next Saturday, so that'll be a great great guest to have for the first 2 o'clock show. And maybe, you know, next year we'll be on at 8 o'clock or 10 o'clock. We'll just kind of keep going later in the day.
Mischke will be fun. That will be a very fun guest.
This will be an interesting show. I think that it'll be get the laugh track out. We have two guests today. My first guest today is Jim Dubois. Jim Dubois is the chair of the Minnesota Broadcast?
Actually, the president and CEO.
Thank you. Okay. President CEO of the Minnesota Broadcast Association. Welcome to Flashback Twin Cities, your first time here.
Tom, great to be here.
Jim, you have been in radio and TV and broadcasting a while.
A long time. Just realized it'll be 40, if we count only commercial broadcasting, it'll be 40 years in... No, I'm sorry. Oh, my goodness. I'm older than I thought. 41 years in July. Now, if we go back to the pirate radio days, which I won't mention, that would take it back to the late 1960s. And then my first actual real radio station was KBEM with the Minneapolis Public School Systems, and that would have been in September of 1971.
So, and that still exists, correct?
It still exists. They have a jazz format now.
Yeah, one of our good friends, Alan Stone, was a big mentor there for many years, and kind of kept that format going.
Right.
So the person over Tom here, he's been in broadcasting since he just turned 16 last year, so he's got 40 years of broadcasting to look forward to there. But so age 14. So what made you get into radio at that young of an age? It's you know, everyone wants to kind of be a star in TV at some point. Well, some of us do, but you got to do that.
Well, you know, it's funny. I loved radio from a very early age. I can even think back, and I actually was able through eBay to acquire every radio I ever owned as a child. And I remember the first radio my parents got me was this little AM only RCA transistor radio, and I loved that because it was so portable. I could take it anywhere I went. I could sneak it under the pillow at night, listen. My parents didn't know. And radio was kind of the soundtrack of my life at that point. And so it was sort of a love affair that never waned. And then a very close friend of our family's owned a radio station in South Dakota, so I got to visit that as a child. I used to go down to WCCO radio downtown, and again, harkens back to a different era, but you could actually walk into the radio station. They would welcome you into the studio. You could sit with Boone and Erickson, and no security. Like, oh, you want to see the radio station? Sure, come on. Want to sit down on the broadcast? Absolutely. So I had a lot of really good early experiences. I remember going out to the old WDGY when they had their studio and transmitter site out in Bloomington. So I spent a lot of time at stations and never really lost the radio bug. And then I have to say, though, a lot of the success I have had in the industry is due probably not so much to talent, but to being at the right place at the right time.
Well, so many of us do, and I'm just trying to go back to those days. You're going to see Boone and Erickson, which was the big thing in the country. Not even so much in Minnesota, but it was the highest rated radio program in the country. And you're watching these two geniuses at work. That had to be awe-inspiring for you to want to go and do your own.
It was absolutely awe-inspiring. And Tom, you're so right. I mean, for folks who aren't familiar with radio ratings, there was a time when WCCO radio had a 60 share, meaning that of all the radios turned on, 60% of the folks listening listened to The Good Neighbor. And that was a juggernaut. I mean, it was basically unduplicated anywhere else in the country. So yeah, it was indeed awe-inspiring.
And at 14, you were able to do your own, now what kind of program were you doing at K? KBEM.
KBEM. Well, at that time, it was a very eclectic format. The station had just gone on the air in 1970. It was out of the old vocational high school in downtown Minneapolis. And I guess the best way to describe the format was eclectic. Mm-hmm. During the day, you'd have Minnesota School of the Air. You'd have colorful compositions where the kids in elementary school would listen to music and supposedly finger paint or who knows what. They had a classical music show. I used to engineer that on Wednesday nights. And I'll have to tell you a sidebar story to that. Is there were two turntables, and the desk where the audio board and the turntables were on wasn't particularly well isolated acoustically. So what I would do while we turn off a device called a compressor, which basically meant in order to maintain the vibrancy of classical music, you didn't want to do much to the signal. So there would be times when the classical music was the volume was really low. So on the other turntable, through the audition channel, a channel that nobody could hear, you know, at home, I'd be cranking the latest rock tunes, and I'd be doing this. And I remember one day I looked down on the board, and there's these two meters on the board, the VU meters, the volume controls, and I watched every time I slapped my hand, I saw that meter go up like this, and I realized while this classical music was playing, I was drumming, and it was going over the air. So that was my my sidebar experience. But long story short, the programming that I did, we had a show called Community Calendar, which was essentially reading community events. I did that. I think it was like 15 minutes, 3 days a week. And if you were really, really lucky, you got to do Sound Factory 70s, which was an hour-long rock show that was on in a lot of the lunchrooms in Minneapolis schools.
So contemporary artists of the 70s and sanitized for listening ears of that those tender ears.
Exactly.
Now, did students actually do the on-air?
They did, yes.
I'm picturing age 14 high school students have these really, I know when I was 14, had this really great radio voice that was somewhere between.
Yeah, exactly. On over in the St. Paul Park.
That's what I sounded like.
That's how I sounded my first day here, too. But I hope there's some tapes of that somewhere. I hope there's an archive of that.
You know, Tom, I hate to tell you, I threw away a tape that I had done once. It was an hour-long consumer concern show, and I was embarrassed. This was like, you know, when I probably had turned 17, and I didn't want any vestige of young adolescence anymore. So I'm sorry to this day that I discarded that tape. You would have laughed. It was funny.
You know, every tape that gets thrown away just kills it, right? But so you actually went on to actually a professional career in broadcasting. You actually worked at, we're talking a little bit before the show started, at WDGY Radio.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Which was a contemporary, you know, pop station. Then it was a country station.
Yes.
And then it was a mix of country and talk. And you were part of the news department at WDGY.
I was, yes, for a number of years. And that was an interesting experience. Again, hearkening back to a different era in broadcasting. We actually, at one point, had four people in our news department.
I'm trying to picture a country station with a news department right now. And then have four people in the news department. And this was during 1984, when Walter Mondale ran for president. You actually trailed him, or you were on part of his campaign.
Right. Well, it was a very formal thing, and you would never hear it in radio today. Of course, this is 30 years ago, but what we would do at the top of every hour, there would be a five-minute NBC newscast, followed up with probably a two-minute local newscast, and then throw in the meteorologist. I mean, we'd probably have, you know, 6 minutes of information at the top of every hour, which would never fly on a music format today. Again, a very different era. But yeah, NBC was a very large network. I guess they've come back. Now, the parent company of NBC got rid of the radio division probably 20-some years ago, the radio news division. But we used to, whenever there was a story of national importance here in the Twin Cities, they would call on us, and oftentimes I'd grab a cassette tape recorder and head out and cover it for them.
I'm picturing the cassette recorder with the microphone and Vice President Mondale right there giving you a scoop. Yeah, our guest today, Jim Dubois, he is the chairman and CEO of the Minnesota Broadcast Association. Just thinking back to that era, and FCC rules were required, every station was required to actually have news and weather at the top of the hour, no matter if you were a satellite music station or if you actually had, you know, live people doing radio, which is a rare thing nowadays. This is one of the few locally owned stations left in the country
I think there's a number of stations out there that have realized that not being live is kind of killing themselves, and a lot of other places are trying to bring more people in to bring that format back to life. It's what people want to hear.
Yes.
Hear the mistakes, hear the flubs. And I know we make plenty of those. So,
oh, not very many. But
maybe it's just me.
You mentioned NBC Radio, and NBC Radio at that point, that was still the oldest radio network. That was the birth of broadcasting.
That's
and
absolutely right.
I think that when GE purchased that network, they decided that radio was not the future, and it is now part of the Infinity Broadcast family, which ironically is part of CBS now.
Yes. It's funny how those things happen.
Yeah. But you stayed at WDVY through
1993. I was with DGY and K102, and then of course we underwent a format change where we, for a while, were a hybrid of news, sports, and talk. And then we morphed completely into a sports station, I believe, in August of 1991 with the call letters KFAN.
Yeah, and that station did okay, from what I understand.
It did okay. No.
At that point, you know, AM radio was left or dead. Let's look at 84. You're working, and not to be offensive here, but you were at a station which was music on AM radio. And at that point, they said that's not the future.
Right.
Then some rules changed, and talk radio became the big thing.
Yes.
And you could have opinions without having to have another opinion, which is what one of the
Fairness Doctrine.
Fairness Doctrine. Thank you. Mm-hmm. And then this guy named Rush Limbaugh, he kind of love him or hate him, he kind of brought AM radio back to life. And with that happening, news talk stations came out there, and sports talk, which was a really new concept. Do you think you can listen to sports all day long? But I'm guessing that the thought was, if ESPN can be on all day long with sports scores, even in a low season, there's no games, why not radio?
Right. Well, it was a big risk, and I remember Mick Anselmo, who now runs the CBS radio stations here in the Twin Cities, was a big advocate for bringing sports to Twin Cities radio, and the chairman of the company that owned the station at that time, Allwright, had his reservations. He had pretty much written off AM radio, even a 50,000-watt radio station like WDGY was, but Mick was a risk-taker, and Mick had wonderful powers of persuasion, which he still does, and was able to persuade the chairman of Allwright to go ahead with this format, and the rest is history. I mean, a very, very successful radio format now on FM. WDGY as an AM station had basically been given up for dead with music.
And the only thing I have to say, the unfortunate thing for me as a historian and classic, you know, person who loves a classic, is the call letters went away. When KFAN came, the call letters, WDGY, Y11.
Right. Yeah, that was a long time of branding. I think the DGY call letters, they weren't the first call letters of the station. They actually had a couple of different sets, but around 1926 or 27, WDGY, of course, stood for Dr. George Young, who was a Twin Cities optometrist who put WDGY back on the air in 1923. Some would say perhaps even before he had the official piece of paper from the U.S. Department of Commerce, the license.
Little pirate radio?
Right.
and to those that don't know what pirate radio is, it's not pirates doing radio from the sea.
That would be great.
I'm sensing a movie idea. It's doing radio from your, and I think there's some people, prominent broadcasters in this town that were doing that kind of radio before.
Oh, yes. There are a few.
Around in a van.
You know, it was funny. I was a few years back during the digital television transition. They had a number of FCC folks in town who were helping us, and we were conducting a lot of public information seminars at various places telling people how to make the transition. And one of them was a lawyer from the FCC, and I remember him asking me how I got my start. And I said, well, I actually started with a pirate radio station back when I was about 10 years old. And I looked at him and said, is it really smart for me to be telling an FCC agent about this? He said, Jim, don't worry. Statute of limitations expired a long time ago. So,
I can't imagine they're going to go back to your house and find the transmitter and the antenna there.
No, but we were safe.
I'd be impressed if it was, though. Because you did buy every radio you ever had in your life, so I'm guessing the pirate radio broadcaster is still there.
Right.
Maybe not. We're on
like
the air.
The shifty eyes that happened just now.
You know, before we incriminate ourselves anymore, let's take a break. Tom, we'll come back with our guest Jim DuBois on Flashback Twin Cities here on KLBB. Flashback Twin Cities, Tom Osmond with my guest Jim DuBois. He is the president and CEO of the Minnesota Broadcaster Association. And Jim, tell me a little bit about the MBA. What is the MBA for those that...
We basically are a trade group that represents the broadcasting industry, radio and television stations, both commercial and non-commercial stations. So anything that really promotes or protects the industry. So a lot of lobbying, both at the state and federal level, obviously great interest in what the Federal Communications Commission is doing, and generally just kind of watching to see what happens in our constantly evolving world of electronic communication. It's a lot different than it was even 5 years ago.
And you've been there since 1996. I'm guessing that the last few years, every year gets a little bit more challenging, a little bit more what's next.
Yes, no, challenging is a very good way to describe it.
Because I'm guessing the 90s, you could see what the five-year plan is. You know, what's the five years for radio? What's 5 years for TV? Okay, digital TV is coming up.
Right.
You know, cable, satellite. How do we integrate all these things? But now, I mean, I look at, like, okay, now we're in 2014. You think of what we've come by from the last 2 years, last 3 years. How does one even predict what's going to be for broadcasting a year from now?
Well, Tom, if anybody could, they'd be a rich person.
That's right.
I think, you know, you talk about five-year plans. I think there was a time where you could have done that. Now I'm not even sure you can do a five-month plan with any degree of safety anymore. So you're absolutely right. It's constantly changing.
And you work with a lot of broadcasters. What is their biggest concern right now? Is our broadcasting going to be so niche we're never going to find an audience again, or is the advertising dollars are flattening? What are concerns you're working through?
I'd say the biggest concern right now is what is the role of terrestrial broadcasting in a multi-platform world? And that encompasses a lot of things. Number one, how can, for example, terrestrial radio, differentiate itself from all the other forms of audio that are out there? There's some people who even say, should we be using the term radio anymore? Mm-hmm. I mean, Nielsen, the company now that measures ratings for radio, calls itself Nielsen Audio. Bonneville Broadcasting used to be Bonneville Radio. Now it's just Bonneville. National Public Radio is just NPR. It's almost like radio has become a dirty word in some quarters. I think to the point that we discussed earlier is that there's a lot to be said for localism, and that will be the one thing that personally, and I'm speaking as Jim Dubois, not the president of the NBA, but that I think is what will keep radio vibrant. Because otherwise, if we're just going to spin tunes and say nothing and not talk about the community, what differentiates us from Pandora or Spotify?
Listening really? To Ryan Seacrest talk throughout the entire country there, and it has nothing to do with you.
Right, exactly.
You know, when I was in grad school back in the mid-2000s, one of my thesis was, will radio survive? And you look at history, you look at from the 20s, and movies and sound movies and TV and VCRs, all these things have competed against radio, and radio's been left for dead so many times.
Yes.
But it survived. And I still believe it's going to survive if you give a good product and you put a product that people want to hear.
Right.
And even AM radio, because AM radio has still been able to fall on it, you know, fall on its 2 feet every single time.
Absolutely.
Every car in America still has, well, most cars in America still have a radio. And you, even me, and I have the satellite radio, I have the iPod, the iPhone, I have all the digital stuff. But you know what? I'd say over half the time, I still have my presets on my radio because I still want to know what, you know, what's going on. I still, even though I have commercials, I think I don't even need to listen to commercials. But there's still something you get from listening to local radio.
Right. Well, the biggest thing I think too is we have to look at the most important thing that radio or television provides is local content. And if you look at what happened to the music industry, to me, that's the poster child of an industry not adapting itself to the realities of the digital world. So the music industry thought, we're in the business of producing physical media, whether it was vinyl discs or CDs or cassettes. And they didn't realize that, well, wait a minute, no, we're in the business of producing music, entertainment for people to consume. So today, had they been smart, if they would have come up with something like iTunes, think about that. Just transfer your platform. You're still selling your core product, your creative product, but it doesn't have to be on a physical piece of media.
I think of the years that the record companies were suing people for downloading music instead of actually looking at equipment or partnering with companies that actually make music available. And you look at Best Buy, Target, these record stores. Remember record stores?
Oh, yes.
He might not. But
right.
You'd go to Great American Music or the Wax Museum. And yeah.
Even Dayton's, the department stores. Mm-hmm. Target used to carry vinyl records.
Right. Well, or even large numbers of cassette CDs. I look at Best Buy today, and granted, the whole consumer electronics world has changed, but there's two rows of CDs now.
Yes.
And for a long time, I think there was a bit of confidence by it, because you'd have one song you'd want, you had to buy a $25 CD, you didn't really want to listen to the other ones, you kind of would, but when Morpheus and Kazaa and Napster came out, that was the big competition to the vinyl media. Apple found a way, wait a second, we can still do this and actually do it legally.
Mm-hmm.
And everyone else scoffed at them, and that's why Apple stock is what it is. And
well, what's very important is that you actually provide a medium for people to conveniently and easily get what they want. Not everyone is a pirate. There are plenty of those out there. But I know, for instance, I like video games, and there are plenty of people who pirate video games. But there's a thing called Steam that makes it very easy to download, purchase, you get sales. It's the easiest thing in the world. They're making money just hand over fist because people will pay you for the convenience.
Mm-hmm.
So just provide them an easy method and no problem.
There's the hit pop star from our community, Minneapolis. You might have heard of him. He just signed a deal with Warner Brothers to release all his old music.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Is he the artist formerly known as? Now he's back known as his original.
I think he rubbed off the symbol and slave off all his albums.
I'm make sure about that.
I remember a few years ago another business I was in, and it was the internet's dead. You know, no music of Prince is going to be on the internet. And I it's kind of funny years later now in 2014 that Prince is going back with Warner Brothers now, and they're going to re-release things digitally. And I'm wondering if even Prince might be changing his mind on the internet.
There's kind of sounds like it. Yes.
There's pride, and then there's money.
Hey, let's talk about Access Minnesota. That is a program that you produce.
Yes, we've been doing it now for we're in our 11th year. We started in late 2003 on the radio. It's on 43 radio stations statewide. We also have it on television on a number of stations here locally in the Twin Cities. Tom, you were a wonderful guest on Access Minnesota TV, I think back in November of 2012, and that, of course, is on our AccessMinnesotaOnline.com website.
Yeah, if you wonder what I look like, you can just YouTube my name, and it pops up there on Access Minnesota. It's not my best TV appearance, but...
I thought you did an excellent job, Tom.
And we had a good time. We were Bud Crailing that day, and we were talking about the glory days of broadcasting. But
yes.
You cover a whole range of topics on Access Minnesota.
We do, and actually, a couple of times, I accompanied the Minnesota Army National Guard to Kuwait and Iraq to cover their mission there, and that was a wonderful experience. Some great folks in the Minnesota Army National Guard. But no, we're really, really fortunate to have a half-hour format every week, and we can really delve into great detail on a lot of different subjects.
And it's on tomorrow, correct? On
it
Channel
is.
23. What's the topic tomorrow?
Not tomorrow. It's on Channel 23, the first Saturday of the month, and KSTP and KSTC-TV on the second Saturday of the month. So this month's topic was actually caring. There is an interesting professor at the University of Minnesota who's written a book about the caring society and why we need to look at the way that we care for people.
So we cover topics from broadcasting to just general current events, just things going on in the community. That's great. That's great. And
side note, we do have Access Minnesota on KLBB Sunday at 7 o'clock.
Yes.
And we can hear it here on Club 1220, 7 o'clock.
Ah, there you go.
Tonight?
7 a.m.
Tomorrow.
Tomorrow. Great. Mm-hmm. So, Jim, tell me a little bit more about what you do with the MBA. So besides the lobbying, besides Access Minnesota, what keeps you busy day to day?
I'd say busy day-to-day is just trying to stay on top of the industry. There's so many changes going on. It used to be that you could avoid reading industry trade publications for a couple of weeks and be fine. Now, if I'm not reading every email that crosses my desk on a daily basis, I feel like I've missed something important. So there's so many things. In the television world right now, we're looking at a lot of different issues. We're looking at some new technologies on the horizon. There's also an FCC incentive auction. People may not know a lot about that, but the FCC, the Federal Communications Commission, is actually incentivizing TV stations to give up their channels. And then they will auction those channels off to the wireless industry. The TV stations will split the proceeds with the government, and supposedly the TV stations will go on happily ever after, either sharing with another broadcaster their programming on that broadcaster's frequency, or just going entirely to internet, satellite, cable. So a lot of big changes.
There are some great things going on with broadcast TV. I know that I've watched antenna TV, and I'm amazed that how great the picture looks on antenna TV now with the new channels that have come up with the digital conversion. Even old programs, which I enjoy, it's a crisp, clear picture of the shows. And there's a future in antenna TV, because I think that one thing that we're finding is the cost of cable TV is
prohibitive in a lot of cases.
It is. There was a point somehow, I remember when cable first kind of came mainstream in the 80s, and the bill was $20-$30, and you were kind of the well-to-do families that had cable.
Right.
And then people caught up, VCRs, cable, but now when internet and cable and phone all converged, we don't even understand the cost of cable anymore and how we somehow became that we can pay. Is Comcast a sponsor of our?
I don't believe so.
Okay. So somehow these exorbitant cable bills, we just take now. And there's a point where I was like, okay, well, I'm watching reruns on cable, which I have the DVD box set of, or I've seen 100 times. And then you look at, there's 30 stations on, you know, on broadcast TV now. There is some great options out there.
Absolutely. And that's the other thing I think that we really need to track is to how consumers are consuming media. And we know that one of the biggest changes is happening in the younger generations. The millennials consume media very differently than the boomers do. Mm-hmm. And I think that's another challenge that broadcasters have, is to watch that pattern and see how they can adapt to it. But there has been a movement toward cutting the cable, and it's being driven, I think, by younger people. But younger people are also consuming media with Hulu, Netflix, so they're not even necessarily watching it on a local station. And that has huge economic implications for the industry.
We end up talking about that fairly regularly, especially for like The Late Show. Our generation doesn't watch the show. We go to the YouTube clip that we heard was great and hilarious.
Yes. Well, and that's the other thing that's interesting too, speaking of YouTube, is how popular the user-generated content is. And I just saw an interesting study a while back saying millennials are more likely to believe their peers when it comes to getting an endorsement about a product. And I've spoken to some younger folks who say, I ask them, how do you decide if you're going to buy a new laptop? I won't go to the Apple website. I'll first of all ask for reviews, and I'll see what my peers are saying, and then I'll make my decision from there. And when you really think about that, how that upends the whole model, it's interesting.
Can you imagine going to a hotel now and not checking reviews before you go to it? That I was watching something on TV last night, and the big joke was they went to a hotel, which was horrible. I thought, well, today you'd never even have that problem, because you look at the reviews and you'd see if what people liked it or not liked it.
Right, right.
Now, you may have a personal opinion after you didn't like it, but, you know, with movies, TV, the instant review process is so fast now. And we, you know, unfortunately or fortunately, we might be missing out on some great art by going to reviews, going to endorsements,
right,
people we respect, or even the internet. It's just very fascinating the way that we're consuming anything right now, including media.
Yes, absolutely. And that's going to be the challenge, is adapting to this. And it's a rapidly shifting paradigm. And, you know, you think back, I often think back about when I had my little RCA transistor radio, that there were probably only about 7 or 8 viable radio stations in the Twin Cities back in the early 1960s. When it came to television, there were 5 stations. Think about how that universe of choices has changed.
We were joking about some headphones earlier. We have some classic headphones here at KLDD.
Oh, the monsters.
Yes.
Dinosaurs.
The Koss headphones. I love them. They're great.
The piece. Now, here's what makes you data. Now, you know, we're a little different in age, but between the three of us, we have three different generations here. And we're looking at, to really date yourself is when you show someone a tape and say, you had to rewind this. And there's a whole generation now that has never understood.
Right.
Never understood. You actually had to stop and rewind this thing. Be kind, rewind. That was a sticker you had to put on all your tapes at Blockbuster.
Yes, that's absolutely right.
I just, it seems so not that long ago, but every year it just fades in memory.
It's kind of like dial telephones. Anybody know how to, going to dial a number? What? With a rotary dial?
I just hit their name on the phone. And
Or say it. Yeah,
exactly. I do remember the rotary phones. We had one of those. Oh, I love that thing.
Jim, thanks so much for being on Flashback Twin City today.
Tom, it was a pleasure.
Looking forward to seeing Access Minnesota the first and second Saturday. First Saturday on Channel 23 at 11?
At 5 a.m.
5 a.m.
And then on the second Saturday at KSTP at 3 a.m. And then on KSTC, Channel 45 at 6 p.m. on Saturday nights, the second Saturday of the month.
And that's a great time. So if you don't, you can DVR it. So you can DVR it on your...
Speaking of new technology. Relatively new technology.
If you have cable or TiVo, or you set your VCR if you still have one of those, and if you want to get rid of it, talk to me. But no, Jim, thanks for having me on again. And
Tom, thank you.
Actually, real quick, you're also on the Paddock Museum Board too, right?
I am. Yes,
it's an organization we support here. So if you want to come out, check out some old radios, go to the Paddock Museum in St. Louis Park.
It's a great place.
Jim, thank you.
Thanks, Tom.
Tom, we're going to take a break, and we'll come back with our next guest. Flashback Twin Cities. Tom Osmond with the third Tom on the program. We have Tom Shue, and now we have Tom Worth. Welcome to Flashback Twin Cities.
Good to be here.
And Tom, you are the founder of Books for Africa.
Correct.
So we talk a lot about TV media, radio media. Another important media is books, and one of the oldest forms of media before any of this low-class entertainment media came. But you are the founder for Books for Africa. Tell me just a little bit about what Books for Africa is. I know people have seen the stamp around. They've seen the sign around. What is it?
Well, in 88, I went to Africa, and I'd been in publishing and bookselling all my life, and I just sold my business. And I came back after a trip to Africa and realized we had a lot of books that we weren't using. They were going in landfills and so on. So I thought, well, we can surely send a few books to... It was Uganda, the first country I was in, so we sent a few boxes. And now, 26 years later, we've sent 30 million books all over the continent. It's incredible.
So since 1988, you've been sending books to Africa, and was it children's books, or was it just... What kind of books were you sending there?
Well, we initially sent children's books, and that's what we talk about mostly. But, you know, they learn to read and write in school, but then they have nothing to read after school. So we also send adult fiction and so on. We send all kinds of books. We don't send very old books. We don't send atlases with the wrong names in and so on, and early encyclopedias, but we send pretty well everything.
And just real quick, you're not from Minnesota. This is not
no,
a,
no, no,
a Swedish
I'm not
accent.
From Minnesota.
Okay.
I came over in 1960. We knew a lot of 8th Air Force people during the war, and after the war, one of them came to see my dad, and this was in the 1950s. He said, "Tom, if you want to see America, I'll sponsor you as an immigrant." It was easy in those days. So he was a lawyer in Eau Claire, so I came to Eau Claire in 1960.
You've been in Minneapolis how long?
Well, I've been went back to England, came back again, so I've been in Minneapolis and the Valley for 50 years.
And you decided to stay. You're one of us now.
That's right. That's right.
That's great. So when did this... So you sent a box initially, and then you wanted to send more. Did you just send it to someone you knew in Africa? How did the connection in order to send more, where did that evolve from?
Well, it started with this library in Uganda where we sent books, and then gradually people said, well, I know this other place I visited, and they need books. And so that's how it multiplied. And now, you know, around the world, we're known for sending books. If people want to send books to Africa, they... You know, Google has done a lot for us. Mm-hmm. Our name, Books for Africa, we had someone went to Ghana one time, and they asked a child on the side of the road directions. And then when they got directions, they asked the child what he wanted most. He said books. They came back to Chicago and Googled Books for Africa. We came up. They gave us $50, and then 6 months later, they liked what we did. They sent us $50,000.
Wow.
Isn't that great?
That's amazing. So people can send not just the books themselves, they can give you money, and you'll find books.
Here's the thing, we need three things. We need books, we need money, and we need volunteers. We need volunteers on Prior off University in St. Paul. We need all kinds of books, and you can deliver them to that warehouse there. And mainly we need money. We figure it costs 50 cents to send a book. 50 children will read the book, so that's... For one penny, you've got an impact on a child now. Isn't that incredible?
Nice.
That's
yeah.
probably part of our success, that story, that, you know, you give us a dollar and you've got 100 impacts.
You know, and I've been to Africa also, and it's you really don't understand, what the other world is until you go out and see what people live in. And it's you can see a TV commercial, you can see, maybe a film, but until you actually go out to a village and see what people are living with, and then we come back here, and, we Americans, I'm not going to go on the political thing here, but we're a very wasteful society. We eat a little bit, we throw the rest away, we read a book, half of it, we toss it away. There's a lot of waste we generate here, and it's that's not the case when you go to Africa and you see people that are struggling just to eat and struggling just to make, make a living.
Exactly. One of the things when you go to Africa, you're amazed at the poverty, but what really amazes you is when you come back and see our affluence.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I sometimes think that we people who have moved to this country appreciate it better than the people who were born here. You know, people tend to complain, but if they would go... anywhere else in the world and see how lucky we are. We're just blessed.
I know, and I remember being, when I was in Africa, and I remember visiting with families, and one of the father of the family, he, in a goat, I was in Nairobi, and his job was to go bring water from, you know, where the water was, bring to the village, and he, you know, made very, very little money, but that's how they did it. And, you know, the clothing they had was all donated clothing that had come through, you know, other charity channels. And they were very nice people. I mean, they, you know, we were there and they were nice to us. They weren't bitter. They weren't angry. We kind of reflect upon ourselves sometimes, and we don't have the right cell phone. We don't have the right, you know, electronics. And it's just a very amazing juxtaposition between our two continents, our two worlds. And I think what you're doing here is fantastic.
My favorite story about that kind of a thing is one of my best friends, his family sponsored a team for the USA Cup that came from Africa. And when they came out here, his mom explained the concept of a grocery store. They did not understand it. They went out to the grocery store, and it's like those 1930s type era movies where the people see the bright lights of the big city for the first time, and they're just awestruck. They cannot believe such a thing exists. That's exactly what it was like for them going into a grocery store.
Another story I have, I asked a lady who'd just come over from Africa, I said, what strikes you about this country? And I said, give me the good and the bad. One of the bad, she said, Tom, you throw these things away. She said, and you just throw them away, you pay to throw them away. You put a refrigerator out at the side of the road and you pay someone to pick it up and throw it away. I mean, at home in Africa, they would use that as a cupboard, you know?
Sure.
So you have an event next week. It's the 50-mile walk from Taylor's Falls to St. Paul.
Yeah, I'm, you know, I love doing walks, and I climbed Kilimanjaro on my 70th birthday. I walked across the Ice Age Trail across Wisconsin in the 90s and then across Minnesota. So you're looking at the only person who's probably walked from Lake Michigan to the South Dakota border. But this walk, anyway, is more modest. We're going to walk from Taylor's Falls to the state capital on Friday, Saturday, and Sunday this coming weekend. It's about 50 miles, and I'm looking for people who want to walk all the way or part way. You know, you can walk one day or half a day. The first day we walk from Scandia to from Taylor's Falls Library to Scandia. The second day from Scandia to Pine Point Park, and then from Pine Point Park to the Capitol Steps. Each day is about 17 or 18 miles, but you can walk half the day.
And to find out more, you can go to eventbrite.com, search Taylor's Falls.
That's right.
Email you at tew1@me.com.
Right. So eventbrite.com. Search Taylor's Falls or email me at tew1@me.com.
And if someone listening had some money or books they wanted to donate, they could go to booksforafrica.org.
Booksforafrica.org. You'll learn about how to be a volunteer or donate books.
Where is it headquartered?
The headquarters is across from the Union Depot in downtown St. Paul. What excites me, you know, I came from England, and as I was growing up, they told me that the Midwest was isolationist. You know, before the Second World War, this part of the world didn't want anything to do with foreign expeditions. So I came here, and now we've created the largest shipper of books. There's nobody in the world sends as many books to Africa. And here, our headquarters is here. Now, our main warehouse, however, is Atlanta because it's closer to the ports. We've got 1 million books there waiting for people to donate funds to send them.
And how many books a year do you send?
We send about 3 million books a year now.
And are you buying books actively, or are these all donated books?
They're all donated. We do buy some special books, and we buy, for example, we buy refurbished computers from the state prison. I think $100, and we pass those along to our partners if they can raise that kind of money.
So, do you only take donations of books, or do you take other items also?
No, we just take books.
That's good.
And I personally am fighting for the real book. You know, digital books are fine, but there are 450 million children in Africa. There's only 50 million in this country. We are never going to provide them with iPods and electronic devices. Mm-hmm. We have to give them a real book. And can you imagine a child growing up knowing how to read and write, because there's great education ethic, without ever holding a book? Imagine.
No, it's just not going to happen. And I've always been curious. Do the people that are being raised in Africa, do they learn English as they're learning their native languages as well, or how
it's a usual question I get.
Yeah.
But the reality is most most of the populous countries were colonized by the Brits, so Nigeria and Kenya and South Africa. Now, the other countries, the French-speaking countries, mm-hmm. don't get many books from France. The French think it's up to the government to do it, so if they don't do it... But in each country, you know, thanks to the internet and the colleges and so on, they're looking for English-language books. So
most of them speak English. Or
they do,
write
yeah.
English.
Now, in most areas, there'll be a tribal language, and before they go to school, they speak the tribal language. They get into school, primary school, in most countries, and they're made to speak English. You know, English is the language of the future, even if my French friends don't like that. But we are supplying French books, but those we have to pay for in Paris, you know, a small amount. So we're helping.
And any kind of level of reading is just fine.
All kinds. We need adult books because they leave school and don't have anything to read.
So if it was a kind of book that you there was a need for, it would be adult books.
Yes, and college-level books are the most valuable, of course.
Textbooks?
Textbooks, you know, primary reading books, all kinds. And we get a great deal of help from local publishers here, you know, Lerner Publishing, Quayside, and the people in Mankato, you know, have all been very generous with giving us new books. You know, if they overprint, we're very, very lucky to get the overprice.
So how many times have you been to Africa?
Oh, I suppose about 8-10 times.
And have you been to all corners of the continent?
I haven't been to Angola, Namibia. The Gambia, we walked across 2 years ago. That's, you'll notice it's only 20 miles across. But I've been to most parts. It's a wonderful continent, and each part is different. You know, we tend to hear when things go wrong, but most of Africa is peaceful. And look at, I'm showing you an annual report, and look at these smiling children. No one's told them they're disadvantaged.
Yeah, no, that's the thing, is, you know, when you... Americans, we're always comparing ourselves to someone else, to someone next to us, and that's one thing I realized, and I found out in Africa is, you know, they were happy. It's sometimes it's what you have, you find happiness with what
you
have.
That's right.
Have you seen changes in the continent since you've been going for 25 years?
Oh yes. For example, in Uganda, when I first went in '88, Museveni just taken power, and there were no cars or anything in Kampala. Now there are traffic jams and all kinds of. Up. There were boy soldiers then. I mean, things have improved tremendously. You know, a lot of small merchants and so on. And I think, you know, the continent goes, nine steps backwards and 10 steps forward. So, mm-hmm.
Yeah, because there's for every regime that falls, then there's another challenge that surfaces up. What do you think? I mean, there's so much natural resource in Africa, and there's so much. What do you think it's holding it back? What do you think, for being there as many times?
Well, you know, we sort of talk about education. I think mm-hmm. education, you know, educated people don't have as many children, and they rise up. You know, we have the story of one of our board members is from Ethiopia. He grew up in rural Ethiopia, and his mother got something with a scrap of newspaper wrapped around it. He read this newspaper, and it said something about the UN. And he said, that's what I'm going to do. He went to college in Addis, and then he came to America, and now he's very successful in Washington, D.C. I mean, all these little stories of someone reading something.
Did you have any idea when you printed your first set of books 25 years ago that this is going to be your...
No,
you
know, never dreamed.
Because you were retiring, right? You were retiring.
Yeah,
you were gonna...
Well, I'm still retired, but I just never dreamed that this Books for Africa would be so successful, but no one was doing it on the scale we're doing it, and we have to do it on a big scale. You know, 450 million children, think of it. We've only sent 30 million books. I mean, we've got to do more. 25 years, all these kids have grown up with no books that we didn't send books to.
Yeah, and so many of us here have books that we are not reading. We have so many books that we've tossed away in the garbage, and that's a tragedy. I'm guessing that even the used bookstores in town probably recycle pounds of books a year.
But eventually I think we're going to have to print books, get large donors to, you know, you can print 1 million dictionaries for 30 cents each. You know, 300,000, that's...
So what you essentially need is a sponsor for something as simple as that.
I think some of the beer companies, you know.
Hey!
There you go. I'm looking at... So you had an event, and you had a jubilee. I haven't seen the former mayor of Minneapolis here. Do you have one of these annually?
She's a great supporter. We have the Tanzanian ambassador coming on the 7th of May to do a fundraiser. And then later this month, we're going to Washington. The South African ambassador to the United States is... came here last year and talked to us, and he's so excited about our events. He went to Atlanta and did an event, and now we're going to his residence later this month, and he's hosting an event for our high-rolling donors.
That's a good word, high-rolling donors. I like that. Tom Worth, our guest today, he's the founder of Books for Africa. And you're the founder. You're not the president anymore. Yeah. But you sound like you're very busy with the organization. You're promoting it today. For a person who told me when he first came in here, he doesn't work for it anymore. He's just the founder. You sound like you got a pretty tight schedule.
well, I love this part. I think people who save their money and then give it away when they die, you know, they're missing a lot of fun. I'd rather give my money away and have all this fun while I'm still alive.
You said you're in publishing. That what you did for a living before you?
I came over in 1960 and in about 65 started a mail order business selling books about cars, old cars, race cars, sports cars, and I grew that business, and in 88 I sold it for more money than I ever imagined. Isn't that incredible? American success story. But what's so exciting about America is you can still do that. Look at these guys in the valley, Silicon Valley.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yep.
You know, young people in this country, we can still do it. We can have a bit of luck, and I had a bit of luck.
But you need to have books. You need to know how to read. Well, you need to be smart.
That's right.
Yeah, it's so many. You know, so you think of even the tech companies, the Apples, the Microsofts. These are garage companies. These are companies that people were in their table, you know, deciding what to do with their lives, and they become
the Facebook guy. Look at him. He invented it at college.
Yeah, he did okay, didn't he? You should get him. You should get him on board on your. He might have a little bit of money to. He might be high rolling donor.
We keep thinking of people we should get on board, but it's not easy. You know, there's a lot of people struggling to get donors, but we think we've got a good story to tell.
And have you been to South Africa?
Yes, I've been to South Africa. I've been to Swaziland a couple of times. That's one of the few remaining kingdoms.
That's right. And English-speaking country, too.
Yes.
And probably one of the more educated countries, actually, in Africa, correct?
Pardon?
One of the more educated countries in Africa.
That's right. I have a story here that my grandfather went to South Africa in 1885 or so, and he joined the Bechuanaland Border Police, which was Cecil Rhodes was around, and he rode with Cecil Rhodes into what is now Zimbabwe, was then Rhodesia, and went to Salisbury and came back. He spent 2 years in Africa and earned enough money, bought a diamond, went back to England, gave it to my grandmother, and it was farmer the rest of the time. So I'm making up for the sins of my colonial forefather.
You know, I've always been curious about this. Since you've gone to Africa, you've walked across this place. When you first went, were you terrified of, like, the bugs, the animals, the critters out there? You mentioned it's not the people all the time.
I'm a risk taker in life, so.
So you're just like, whatever. I mean, I can take a bug.
He came on our show, so he takes risks. You know, came to talk to us. No, I just think this is so great, and I think that, and you can actually just go to the downtown headquarters too and drop off books and money too, right?
You can, yeah. Our warehouse on Pryor takes books pretty well anytime.
Okay. I want to talk about this walk again. So it's April 25th, 26th, 27th, the 50-mile walk from Taylor's Falls, St. Paul. Walk on a route from Taylor's Falls Library to the State Capitol in St. Paul, follow backcountry roads to Scandia on Friday through William O'Brien State Park and Marine Jackson's Meadow Trails to the Outing Lodge at Pine Point Park on Saturday. Walk a full length of the Gateway Trail to the State Capitol on Sunday. Participants can do all or part of the route, or join us for the last leg in downtown St. Paul in celebration of the steps of the state capitol. Join Tom Worth in raising funds for Books for Africa. We'll carry a donated book on this first leg of its journey to Africa. Solicit pledges to support our cause. The walk will also highlight the need for the northern continuation of the Gateway Trail.
If you're not a walker, join us on the capitol steps at 4 o'clock on next Sunday.
Be there for the celebration party.
For the celebration party, we hope to have Keith Ellison and a few notable Somali students and so on there.
That's fantastic. Again, the website is booksforafrica.org. Also, for more on the event, you can email Tom at tew1@me.com, eventbrite.com, search Taylor's Falls. I think everyone should check out their basements for books, and I think they should contact you, and I think this is a great thing, and I hope that I wish you all the continued success and for the great event next weekend.
Thank you, Tom.
Thank you, sir. Tom, are we ready to go?
We are, sir.
All right. Well, we'll be back next Saturday with another Tom. We only have Toms on our show now. We have Tom Ischke on next Saturday.
That's a trend.
So we'll, at 2 o'clock next Saturday, Flashback Twin Cities. Till then, we will be, well, we'll see you next Saturday. KLBB, Club 1220.